Well, it's a dynamic duo, we'll be back again. Nothing back with DJ, you better pack it in. You're lacking sense, trying to tangle with us. Go with the big black bullies in the back of the bus. Just smacking you up, and stealing your lunch money. You're such a buddy, you're feeling just a touch. Only by the end of the day, that's understandable. What can I say, you got strong man to be.
Gary has absolutely no idea what has happened to it. Still doesn't know.
I was going for the IndyCar rolling start, you know, just drive around for a while. Yeah,
this start has been yellow flagged, but we weren't in proper formation. So this is the Bulls podcast. I'm Doc, he's Bezo. And are we a basketball podcast or are we full Euros?
Well,
high-pitched questioning noise. We're onto something.
Let's say 50% Euros, 10% basketball, 30%. T20 World Cup. That's actually got 10% interesting.
10% miscellaneous. I know it's miscellaneous, but a mate of mine always pronounced it miscellaneous. It always tickled me.
5% coaching corner.
105.
So I have Euro questions for you. You have Euro questions.
Well, I have Euro answers. Well, I have Euro talking points. So,
like, I haven't watched this much football. I watched a fair bit of the Women's World Cup, but I don't think I watched the last World Cup this way. I think it was the one before.
No, I didn't watch any of the last World Cup because it was in fucking Qatar, and fuck Qatar.
Yeah, but I don't know whether it's my memory, but the game seems a lot more skilled now and a lot more egalitarian. Spain looks like the only side to me that it's just like, you know, that they're the, to bring it back to it, some sort of NBA thing. You know, the guy on the short trigger that shoots a three-pointer 3 seconds into the shot clock. Like, if any of those guys are anywhere near a chance of a goal, they'll just pull the trigger rather than making the pass.
Well, but I don't know if that was – if you're talking specifically about the Spain-Italy game, the thing about that was that all of the fucking dialogue about that game was that Spain batted Italy and Spain were, you know, unlucky not to win 4-0 and all this kind of stuff. But the game I saw was just a whole lot of Spain taking a whole lot of speculators from distance.
That's what I mean. Like,
to be fair, particularly in this tournament, for whatever reason, those sort of shots are going in. It's like its own goals and speckies.
Yeah, there's been some amazing gold.
And that might be the ball or whatever. But, Spain massively outshot Italy because Italy, as usual, created fuck all. But, you know, in the last 5 minutes of that game, they had multiple chances to win that game or at least draw it. So, you know, but that aside, watching them in the Croatia game, I think probably gave you a better indication of how they play. They weren't as, like, extreme in terms of their outcomes, but they much more extreme in terms of their goal scoring. They were 3-0 up by halftime and looked to be bossing it. That's the team that I think going into the tournament, there was a lot of chat about France and England being the favourites, like the first line of favourites, and then you might have others like Spain, Germany, Italy, whoever else below that. I think Spain and Germany have played their way in form into being the highest levels of favourites because Germany have done nothing for like 8 years. They've been horrible pretty much since they won the World Cup in 2014. They've been horrible. And then obviously Spain are playing really nice fluid stuff. And England and France have, you know, by the same token, have kind of played their way a little bit out of favouritism by playing either really dour, unimaginative football or just being England and being shit.
I guess what I've been seeing is this sort of dexterity, small passes into tiny space. Like, there's been a lot of really interesting stuff in front of goal and not necessarily for goals, but got, you know, that real Spurs make the next pass, get, you know, turn a 10% shot into a 30% shot into a 50% shot.
San Antonio Spurs, not Big Angel Spurs here, folks, because we do have to make the clarity with given that we're crossing codes.
That's
here.
Right, if we're talking football. And like the perfect example I've sort of got was this, I can't remember the game, but a guy got the ball and as the guy passed it was almost like a pick and roll. Like, so he passed it and then sort of came right round the pick. And as he came round the pick, the defender sort of had to, slide off onto that player because otherwise he would have had an even better angle at the goal. And as soon as that guy took a step away, you know, the shot went straight into that space that he'd been. And I was just like, oh, that's really high skilled, really.
It's like a basketball movement. Yeah.
Yeah, really patient, really. I don't know. I've really enjoyed watching the football, and some of the longer ball stuff, or even the longer passes, just seems to have a lot more purpose than that sort of bomb it in Australian English style that I remember from when I first started watching, which was sort of hit and hope. This is sort of hit and a guy can bring it down from a 30-meter pass out of the air onto his foot, tap it, and then smash it into the side, you know, into the side of the net. Like the dexterity and the skill level seems.
And Slovenia and Slovakia can do that shit. I mean, it's not just the teams at the very top. The quality, you know, all these teams have people who are playing on very high level teams in Big Five leagues.
Yep. And I don't think I've seen. Now, admittedly, I probably only watched half of the games in full with Curtis, and the rest of it's been highlights. And highlights tend to not give you, you know, if you're watching 15 minutes of a 90-minute game, you're not missing all the boring bits, I guess. But
it would have made England-Denmark actually watchable, for example.
But, yeah, I've been super impressed with the pace and the different styles and, I don't know, the lack of sort of showboating up front. You know, a lot.
Well, Portugal played today. There was quite a lot of, you know, saw a lot of people go down for a lot of fouls that didn't exist, and a lot of Ronaldo throwing his hands in the air when he was missed by the pass that was never going to come. Although that was hilarious. There was the second goal for Portugal today against Romania was there was a ball. Ronaldo was demanding the pass through, and he didn't get it. So he's off having a flounce, and the video, the camera operator's focusing on Ronaldo having a flounce. But in the meantime, the Romanian defender has kicked it back to his keeper, but the keeper is out of position because he's come for the ball, and it's just concentrated in the fucking
goal.
Straight
passing, so Paul Barson.
Ronaldo probably should get an assist for that. You know, it was a kind of a decoy run.
So that was my second point: is there a bad goalkeeper in this competition? That's just been some absolute. Like, I still maintain it sucks to be a goalkeeper because you can have an awesome game and have, you know, either two bad bits of play or two bits of play that are just simply beyond, you know, your comprehension or ability to affect. But, you know, some of these games, these guys are getting absolutely peppered from all different angles. And
yeah, Donnarumma in the Italy-Spain game had that a lot. But they love a game like that where they have a lot of long shots, where they have a lot of opportunity to do the big, languid diving saves because they have more time and they get to look really cool. It's the ones where I was in one game today. I think it was disallowed in the end, but someone hit a shot off the keeper's face and then that bounced off. I think it was Slovakia's dude's the Czech guy's chest and then off his hand into the goal and eventually got called back for handball.
So that was the third thing I wanted to ask is, like, I see a lot of Premier League and European leagues sort of, you know, disparaging and generally hating the VAR. This seems pretty quick and pretty. It's like we project a line across the thing. If you threw the, it's like almost like an NFL sort of technology, isn't it? If you threw the plane, then you're offside. Too bad.
Yeah, it seems a lot better than it is in the EPL for whatever reason. In fact, the only game where there was a real VAR fuck up in Euros was one where there was EPL refs. So obviously they're not used to this. Fucking make a decision fast, rely on the semi-automated offside. They've also got this snickometer because there's a chip in the ball.
Yes, I have seen that. Yeah, with a few handballs or balls off arms,
the ball can detect where it's hit something, and some of the handballs have been indicated by the sound wave thing. So we are potting at you from the end of the second match day. So there is still one game left for everybody. And the only people who are guaranteed through to the next round are Germany, Spain, and Portugal because they've got two wins. Tomorrow morning, our time, Germany and Switzerland play off for the lead of Group A. Scotland still have a shot at qualifying. Actually, Hungary still have a shot at qualifying as well, but they'd have to be super lucky because the top two in each group go through plus three of the six third place teams, depending on. And you probably need.
Oh, okay. So it's not just top two, right?
Yeah. Well, it's the top two plus the best third place teams. You'll probably need at least 4 points to go through like that. Looking at the way the groups are. So a win and a draw, it should be enough to get you through. Having said that, there's one group, Belgium's group, Group E.
Yeah, everyone's on
Everybody
three.
Has a win. So if both the games in that group end in draws, someone is going to finish fourth, with 4 points, it has to go home, and that's going to be a bit disappointing.
Especially since Belgium is my team.
Yeah, well, you were. Well, I feel like, have Belgium really turned up to the tournament if they haven't played in their Tintin uniforms yet?
No, I've been very disappointed. I keep turning it on, waiting to. Yeah. I've even got the boys reading Tintin comics in preparation. You know, yeah. This is the whole thing.
And here's the problem: they're playing Ukraine next, and that's not a clash of colours. So I'm not sure whether they. I mean, they'll probably play in their away. They probably wear it playing their away shirts anyway, just because they brought them, and Ukraine will be in yellow. So, although to be honest, those are two light colours, and often they want to have a dark and a light colour. You know, it's almost like the old black and white. So that you can tell the difference on black and white TV. It's more just to help people who are colorblind. But after they've hyped these fucking jerseys up, you'd like to think they'd actually bring them. But yeah, Slovakia, Romania, Ukraine, and Belgium are all on 3 points. And the thing is that Romania beat the Ukraine by, Ukraine. They're not the Ukraine anymore. They're like the Lebanon. Romania beat Ukraine 3-0 and then turned around and got beaten 3-0 by Belgium. So it's kind of one of those groups where anyone could beat everyone. Slovakia beat Belgium in the first match day. And that was... a real kick in the ass for Belgium, I think. I think that's kind of the slap in the face they really needed. It reminds me a little bit of when Argentina lost to the Saudis at the start of the last World Cup, or there was, I think, Spain lost to Switzerland at the start of the 2010 World Cup in South Africa, and that, you know, drummed out any remaining...
Essentially spiked them.
Yeah, drummed out any remaining complacency, whereas England losing to Iceland doesn't seem to have done much. It just turns out they are actually that bad.
Well, I said to Curtis before the tournament, I said, okay, you got to have a side that you follow, right? You don't have to. It's not for life. It's just, who are you going to follow for this European? He's like, oh, all right. So he's looking at all the team lists and, you know, which players do I know? And he's like, all right.
So you've got to follow somebody in each game. That's the point. You should be following someone in each game. I think,
which he does, because he's like, oh, I like this defender, or I like, you know, this. He's much more knowledgeable than I am. But he's gone, oh, I'm going to follow Spain, but my best mate, his mum's German, so Germany are going to be my second team. I'm like, well,
it's like, yeah,
haven't you rolled the dice well?
Yeah.
You should be covered pretty well there.
Yeah, exactly right. Melbourne Storm fan in the league as well, I suppose. Yeah. So the Scots got voted, like, the most welcome fan base by the Germans, which is nice because I think they turn, unlike the English or the Serbians or something, they don't turn up and, you know, get on the piss and throw plastic furniture across the town square. They actually turn up and are pleasant and are generally good company. But if they get a win off Hungary, and Hungary have been pretty poor, they could well make the second round for the first time in the history of professional organized football, which is a bit of an indictment of a lot of things. You were talking a bit about underdogs because you threw a question at me like who are the underdogs in this that almost like you could use as inspirations for the Frillo team who you're coaching. And the problem is that the underdog story only lasts as long as, you know, Albania have been fantastic in the games they've played. You know, they scored first against Italy and against Croatia. They took Croatia to 2-2. They were unlucky to lose 2-1 to Italy. They've got 1 point and they're going to go home unless they can get something off Spain. And admittedly, Spain will be, you know, half throttle and probably resting a few people, but that's tough. It's hard to be, you know, to be an underdog in a game where you get three chances to play.
So what about a side like Denmark or Belgium or
I wouldn't call
Romania,
given that Belgium are perennially ranked number one in the world, I don't think you can claim that they're underdogs.
Okay.
They're just underperformers. Denmark will be through to the round of 16 if they beat Serbia, and England will be through to the round of 16 if they avoid defeat against Slovenia or if Denmark don't beat Serbia, because they've got to win. England are essentially qualified for the next round because they've got 4 points. So they're probably going to be one of the best third place teams.
Oh, I would never use them as an example, but England might be the side, right? Because how long has it been since
they've really badly coached? Like I've heard English pundits say we might be the worst coached team at this tournament. Because they've got more talent. That if you look at the talent there, admittedly there is kind of an EPL tax that anybody in the EPL is going to be overrated compared to, you know, like they're not that much better than people who are getting around in Serie A or La Liga or even the Bundesliga. But you look at the spine of that team and it's full of Man City and Arsenal and all these fucking amazing teams, Real Madrid, and the best is not being made of that talent base. So, you know, it's hard not to feel that it's tactical.
Well, even Curtis was looking at the starting lineup going, hang on, how come this guy's not playing in this position and this guy's not playing? And I'm thinking, well,
exactly. If your kid can figure it out.
Someone at Curtis's level.
Why is Trent Alexander-Arnold being stuck in central midfield? The whole point of Trent Alexander-Arnold, why he does really well for Liverpool, is that he's a fullback who, when he goes into midfield, he can create damage. Don't start him in midfield because, you know, you're not playing the party.
He's got to be that Craig Bradley extra player from the back, and when he makes a run, you know.
Bradley reference. Holy shit. But yeah, that's the kind of idea, is that you can't, your variation can't be your stock ball. And that's kind of what, you know, where Trent Alexander-Arnold is in this sort of situation. It's been pretty dour and pretty dire from England. But, you know, they've got to play Slovenia, who are not terrifying, but Slovenia is still a chance of making. Slovenia on 2 points, they're a, if they get 1 point out of that, they still might make it through. Although, I don't think 3 points will be enough to make it through. There'll be too many other groups that have a 4 point third place player. France have been Didier Deschamps. They're almost in a similar situation to England in that they have ridiculous amounts of talent, but Didier Deschamps refuses to let them get out of first gear.
Let them lose.
But I suppose the other problem is that they played Austria in the first round, and Austria are A, quite good. It seems that Ralf Rangnick running up and down shit works quite well. And B, incredibly violent. Like, Mbappe broke his nose. That wasn't really the fault of Austria. That was Mbappe trying to head Kevin Danso's shoulder into another suburb. But, oh, mate, I can't remember whether it was Danso or one of the other guys, put Antoine Griezmann through an advertising hoarding. He came out bleeding from the head. They put a bandage on his head. He looked like Benny Elias in that famous Origin game where he's bleeding through his fucking bleeding through his head through bandage. The Crimea War look, as Roy and HG called it. It was very Crimea War look from Griezmann. And then Mbappe was out for the game against the Netherlands. The Dutch look pretty good. I think the Dutch aren't at the top level of contenders, but they're not. They're going to cause some problems for people, and they could still qualify as group winners out of this group. I mean, they've got Austria, which is a trickier game, and France have got Poland, who are already home, but it's you never know. I mean, France are as kind of uninspired as they have been, and Poland say, fuck this, we're not going out without putting some points on these pricks, then, you know, the Dutch could go through as group winners.
So does this go round of 16 and then eliminations, there a second group stage?
No, it's all single elimination from here on. And obviously some of the group winners get a third place team. All of the group winners get seeded in a draw. It's not seeded as much. And there are some round of 16 games that are second place teams playing each other. So it's a little bit hard to follow compared to a 32-team tournament, where, you know, it's very easy. Top two, eight groups of four, and then the top two, and then, you know, it just proceeds
one,
through.
One place two all the time.
Yeah,
so does goal difference, like if you're top of the pool plus you've got a better goal difference, does that mean you get one of the third, or is it
it's already selected. So Spain are playing a third place team. I'm not sure whether that was because it was seeded in that Spain were in this group, and therefore the totals, the number, you know, the rankings of the teams in this group means that the group itself is seeded higher, so it gets a third place team. I'm not sure if that's how that works. It might just essentially just be random. Like Spain against the third place, and then they play, or the winner of that game in the quarters plays the first in group A versus second in group C. So right now, that would be Germany versus Denmark, for example. So it's entirely possible for Spain and Germany to end up on the same side of the draw, meeting in the quarterfinals. Portugal could be playing somebody like the second place in D or E. So they could be playing the Dutch or the French, or they could be playing whoever finishes behind Belgium, assuming Belgium win Group E. So it's not as easy to kind of game out. You do have to kind of squint at it and go, well, who the fuck's that going to be?
Again, from watching highlights, which I understand is not the perfect snapshot of the game, it doesn't feel like getting a third place team is necessarily going to be that much of an advantage. It seems like there's some pretty good teams that have been pretty unlucky. Like, that's the other thing that's been really reinforced from watching this is football is just such a, like, I understand there are games that you win just because you're better, but there are also games and win where you just have that bit of luck go your way. Or, you know, the keeper just has an absolute blinder and you have 10 shots on goal and none of them go in, which I understand is a skill thing, but, you know, that seems more like if you replay that sort of game, you know, a keeper is a little bit like a test batsman. You make one mistake, you're gone. I don't know. It doesn't seem like completely two levels? Like, it's, no. It seems a lot more even than I expected.
It's a lot more even than it's talked about. I mean, people talk about it like it's club football, where you say, well, Man City's already won the next three Premier League titles, and, you know, Bayern Munich have already won the next couple of Bundesligas, because, the narrative around it and the actual level of talent is a lot closer. Basically, it's like a huge Western Conference of the NBA, where anyone can fucking beat anyone, and in the end, whoever wins this would probably get beaten by whoever wins Copa America, which makes Copa America like the Eastern Conference, full of crap teams, but, you know, one or two really, really good ones.
Very good at the pointy end.
Yes. Well, who can feast on the beaten up leftovers that are at the end of it. Do we talk about basketball?
Shall we talk about the least interesting final series in the history of the world?
The most unsatisfactory, and it's not just because the Celtics won. I mean, it's a lot because the Celtics won, because it was between the fucking Celtics and the team owned by Donald Trump's biggest donor and Israel's biggest fucking, you know, financial supporter. And, I mean, you can say what you like about Israel, but I'd really rather they'd stop bombing the shit out of Gaza. That would be nice. Please stop doing that. Not to get all political, but, you know. I think it's been seen as a completely unsatisfactory finals by everyone. And the level of interest in it kind of is shown by a couple of things. One, the fact that while it was on, the NBA narrative only wanted to talk about the Lakers fucking up their coaching search and fucking Charles Barkley quitting television in a year's time. There was so much fucking content about that. And then when the title was won, often that's the time you do your news dump, like the Pistons saying, hey, we're going to fire Monty Williams.
Wow, thinking that we've got to come back to that one.
Well, but they were saying, or maybe they think, well, people will be distracted by the title. The fucking narrative had moved on. No one gave a shit about the Celtics winning their title, and they were already more than happy to talk about the Pistons fucking sacking Monty Williams and JJ Redick getting the Lakers job and Josh Giddey for Alex Caruso, which was a trade that sounded like one of those stupid Bill Simmons, you know, he says no kind of trade, straight up player for player kind of things.
I actually think that's a win-win trade myself. Like,
well, yeah, you're not going to be allowed in the NBA tent, because the NBA tent hates Josh Giddey. Like, if they almost hate him as much as they overrate Alex Caruso. Like, I'm not sure why. I mean, Alex Caruso is a really good defensive guard, no question.
Yeah.
But I feel like the reason that he is massively rated by NBA blog boys, like white American NBA commentators, is that they think he's one of them. Because he is bald and pasty, they don't quite get that he's also good at basketball, which is the thing that most of them never could be.
Only averages 21 minutes a game. Not a starter.
Yeah,
like not a starter level player. Yeah. Like,
but I suppose the problem with one of the reasons that Presti shipped Giddey off, the way Presti framed it in his media release to kind of sculpt the narrative, was that Giddey balked at the idea of having a bench role permanently and asked to be sent somewhere else.
Mm.
But, you know, he's replacing somebody who would have had a bench role going forward. Now, they're going to be a terrifying defensive team, OKC, but, I just didn't enjoy all that. I mean, I don't think Giddey's I think he's a questionable human being, or at least he's made some questionable choices, which, you know, 20-year-olds tend to do. But I don't think he's as bad as everyone fucking goes. I mean, partly it was because Caruso had been shopped for multiple first-round picks, presumably low first-round picks.
But that's the thing, right? Everyone's treating this like Giddey is 25. The dude's 21.
Mm.
The dude's 21 and the last two seasons has played in a side that's not even close to his side, right?
He'll be younger than future first-round picks that the Bulls make.
Absolutely. That's correct.
And look, all the Bulls need to do is bring back the scorekeepers that they had when Michael Jordan was around. They can juice his numbers and he can be Defensive Player of the Year. Shouts to Tom Haberstroh.
Zach LaVine, DeMar DeRozan, none of those guys are going to be a foundational piece of a side that is not a play-in side.
Yep.
Giddey actually has the chance to be that. I'm not saying that he is going to be, but he has the chance to be. And if you're struggling to make the play-in, you got to do something different. And draft picks, like, you know what you're getting with Giddey, right? You can at least project out what he's going to be.
He is a high pick that you actually know the outcome of. Because plenty of these high picks, you know, Bagley and Wiseman and fucking, you know, yada, yada, yada. You make the pick. I mean, the thing is that they have a higher premium. It's a bit like, you know, buying a brand new car. It's worth more before you drive it off the lot. Giddey is worth less because he exists. He is not the idea of a high pick. The problem is, high pick in this draft is fucking useless. This is
nothing.
It's easy to run this draft down, but the way it was described, I can't remember who it was by. Might have been Sam Vecesny or Vecesny. I think that's a brand of caravan. But the way I saw it described was, this is like any other draft, but just imagine the top five picks don't exist. It's still the same level of talent.
It starts at 6 or 7.
Basically, it's a draft that starts at 6 or 7.
And that's the thing. Like, once you get into that 7, 8, 9, 10 range, like, it's an absolute crapshoot. You're getting a guy that you know is in that 6, 7, 8 range. So you're essentially getting the number one pick, and he's had 3 years of development in the OKC system. Like, that just seems like a much safer bet than the sixth pick in this draft or whatever OKC or someone else has. I don't know. I just thought if Giddey was 26 and already on, like, at the end of, like, he was on the end of his next contract.
If he was Ben Simmons, I can understand that. And I think that's the thing. He's basically getting Ben Simmons comps in terms of the fact that he allegedly can't shoot and, you know, is a zero. But fucking hell, man, he's not that bad. And we'll defend Ben Simmons. He'll come back.
Have a look at that stretch that Giddey played when, you know, that Shea had the, I think it was a knee or a shin, and they sat him for a whole road trip, like a 15-game road trip. And he played awesome. Like, you know, he played exactly how you would hope that he would develop. But the thing is, OKC don't have space for him to be that sort of player.
No.
Chicago do. Chicago exactly can right. basically well, let sadly, him run.
They need somebody to play the Lonzo Ball role, because it doesn't look like Lonzo Ball's going to be playing any roles for quite a long time if he plays any ever again.
I think the podcasters can be coaches joke kicking around was probably the worst thing to happen to NBA podcasts for quite a while.
Yeah. Oh, we had this. I mean, didn't we say Mind the Game was a fucking audition tape, a recruitment video, some self-taping to kind of pitch for the job? By episode 1 or 2, it was quite clear he was trying to demonstrate that he had a connection with this guy and he was extremely smart about basketball. The thing is, Redick to the Lakers is fine, because if it goes badly, he can survive, he can rebuild. I mean, he's got to put his media career on hiatus, but can always go back to it.
Yeah.
But it is one of the worst jobs in the NBA.
Yes, because everyone's like,
the roster isn't great, and it's clear that fucking franchise does not value coaches at all and hasn't since fucking Phil Jackson left.
Everyone was like, oh, you know, is JJ going to be a good coach? And I'm like, it's really sweet how you guys think that JJ's got any effect on whether that team's going to go well or not.
And it's really, really sweet. You think it matters that's actually going to be the reason he stays in the job or not. I mean, Darvin Ham made the conference finals the year before he got fired. Frank Vogel won the title the year before he got fired.
Not that long ago.
They treat coaches like fucking Chelsea do, or like Man United do. And it was a big, you know, it was a big week for faded Giants getting laughed at for not being able to secure anybody to fucking go and work for them, because the same week that your man Dan Hurley decided, actually, no, fuck it, I'll stay in college, I'll get paid more, because I think he was actually going to get, it was essentially going to be a pay downgrade to come and play for the Lakers, as it will be for JJ, because he has to give up all his media shit. But in the same week that I keep wanting to say Jade Hurley, who was like a 50s rocker, the same week that Dan Hurley turned them down, Thomas Tuchel was turning down Man United and all this other shit was going on. So it's like, maybe if you run your organization really fucking badly, people don't want to come and work for you anymore. It's really weird.
Well, maybe JJ's going to hire Pep now that he's got a taste for the NBA.
The weird thing about Pep is that none of his good players have played particularly well in this tournament. It's almost like they don't. The kind of players who play well under Pep aren't necessarily players who play well out of structure. Obviously, Kevin De Bruyne was really good today, but Kevin De Bruyne is an old man. He's played a lot of football. You know, Phil Foden has been essentially bad for England, and he is the centrepiece of Pep's, the English centrepiece of that team of Pep's. And there's a few other examples as well.
How good is it to be Monty Williams?
Well, Monty Williams might not ever get another coaching gig.
Probably won't need.
But Monty Williams might not ever need another coaching gig. And my question is, did DeAndre Ayton cure him of ever wanting to be a coach again? Because it was after DeAndre Ayton that he went, I'm going to quit coaching. I'm going to take a year off. And then the Pistons owner just backed up the fucking truck and just gave him more money than he could say no to. And then he turned up and did the most. He was basically the dude from Office Space who just turns up trying to get fired. And eventually he did get fired, so now he can fuck off and just count his money. And I think that's quite good. But it's funny that as Monty Williams leaves, another guy who looks like he has been trying to get fired out of every coaching gig he's ever had, Jeff Van Gundy, is back in coaching. because he was secretly, or not secretly, but nobody really talked about it. He was consulting for Missoula,
not a coach. So,
he was helping Missoula with his homework with the Celtics, kind of to build his credibility back, I think. And now he's lead assistant for Ty Lue at the Clippers, so he can help.
Is that
count the bandages?
Is that a get my head back in the game, so I've got some fresh stories to tell when Amazon hire me at the end of next season?
No, I think the Van Gundys, less so Stan. I heard a really interesting and sad interview with Stan, with Dan Labatard, who obviously they've been connected for many years because Stan has coached in Florida for many years. Stan's wife passed away by her own hand, very sadly, about a year ago. So Stan doesn't really feel like doing much of anything. So while he's been fantastic in the booth for TNT, he clearly doesn't want to go back to coaching. But also Jeff Van Gundy has been going through a lot because obviously he's had that happening in his family, but you know, a whole lot of other chaos has been going on. But no, I think Van Gundy kind of knows that he's not, that his style was of a time. Reminds me a little bit of when Ian Smith got the New Zealand wicketkeeper, the grumpy old man. He was the cornerstone of Sky Sports cricket coverage and also their rugby coverage. But when the New Zealand domestic cricket rights moved to a different provider, they didn't pick him up, and he was banging on about it being wokeism and, you know, all this kind of shit. He was too white and too male. And that was kind of the point. No, he was just too old. It's interesting that he's been picked up by Fox in Australia, who are trying to claim that all these ancient fucking idiots that they've reanimated are kind of their version of the Tony, Bill and Richie of their fucking collective. But with Jeff Van Gundy, his style has aged out. Just being grumpy and cynical and all that kind of stuff worked fine when it was Mark Jackson to play off, because Mark Jackson is endlessly positive and stupid and has lots of ridiculous catchphrases. But I don't see a NBA telecast that Jeff Van Gundy's style works in, whereas Stan's is much better for that sort of shit.
And I do think Amazon are going to look to do something different. Like NBC might go back to a bit of a retro feel, because they can, right? They can
play NBC off that. Will be dudes in suits, yeah.
Yeah, they can play off that nostalgia.
But Amazon will probably – did I know whether you ever saw the TNT Tuesday games? Where Adam Lefkoe and Dwayne Wade and Candace Parker, yeah, those sorts of people were on it. I reckon it'll be more like that. I reckon that'll be the vibe.
And then shall we finish on the T20 World Cup?
Oh, I'd rather talk about Jason Tatum's world tour of corniness, to be honest. Just trying to recreate memes.
Actually, no, we do have to talk about the fact that the Celtics love their city so much that they couldn't even wait a day.
Yes, and they went to party in Miami. They all want to be in Miami, fucking hell. But yeah, Jason Tatum is just the corniest motherfucker in the world. He's going around sort of, he's like, everything is possible, just ripping off every other, like, famous victory celebration you can imagine, you know, posing with his leg up like Kobe and trying to, you know, using Steph's line when Steph won finals MVP, notwithstanding the fact that Jason Tatum did not win finals MVP. Yeah, corny little man. And this is part of the reason, another reason why it doesn't really matter that you won. If people just think you're corny and shit, it's never really going to move the needle.
Well, it is going to be in an interesting couple of years in the NBA, because I think none of the teams or the NBA are really sure. And I was listening to, I think it was Lowe, and he was saying, like, all these teams are not really sure how this second apron stuff's going to really play out. And the fact that if you make a wrong move now, you could really screw yourself up for a 5 or 6 year period.
Hello, Timberwolves.
Yeah.
Hello, and even Clippers.
The poster boy of that is the Nuggets. You know, everyone's like, oh, they've got to re-sign KCP. You know, they can't let KCP go. And someone was saying, well, they might, because while it might mean that they're not as good a chance next year, you don't want to not have a chance for the next 4 years, right? Because all you need is a bit of luck stuffed for you to fall your way, and you can have an easier run through the finals, and you can be a little bit fresher, and you can be the Celtics. But I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. Well, I just think the Suns are screwed, right? The Suns, just write the Suns off for the next decade.
Oh, no. 26 other teams would trade fucking rosters with them tomorrow, according to Matt Ishbia.
Yeah, good luck with that, Matt. Ah, dear.
So how you feel right about your Philippines roster? 26 other countries would trade with you tomorrow?
26 other countries don't know we exist.
26 other countries don't play touch football. Actually, no, didn't you say we were like 31 in the group?
31 or 32, I think, in our group.
You kind of needed to be 32 so you can have the nice fucking bracket. You can have the four groups of eight and quarterfinals and shit, just like the World Cup, which is going to move to 64 teams, so which is going to they're going to fuck up the perfect system by doing that next year.
We're not quite at the football stage of being able to demand qualifiers either, I guess. Hopefully our sport gets big enough to do that one day. But at this stage, it's you want to come, you can come. Makes for a great event, though, because you do get a real range of player and a real range of sort of exposure to some of those smaller countries, even our kids.
Yeah. And then you get to a stage maybe in a decade or three where you're a bit like the situation in the T20 World Cup where some of these minnows can genuinely knock off the big – I mean – obviously, you did this in the age group tournaments in Asia Pacific, but you know, a Philippines might be able to win their way into a semi final. The way that Afghanistan have probably knocked Australia out of this T20 World Cup with this afternoon's win, Afghanistan just have to beat Bangladesh essentially, and that's that for Australia. It doesn't matter what they really do. But you know, if you lose to Afghanistan, you shouldn't be in the tournament. You know, that's why New Zealand are at home. But I was just bringing that up to mention that I was looking at the fixtures on Cricket Info, and it included all of the T20 international fixtures. And that's how I learned that Serbia and Slovenia are having a bilateral tour in T20 cricket.
Yeah, right.
I think there's some European qualifiers for whatever the next major tournament is.
Yeah, so I was just curious there for a second, like, who's won the most Euro titles? So Germany 3, Spain 3, Italy 2, France 2, and then it's Netherlands, Czech, Slovakia, Russia, Greece, Denmark, Portugal with one.
Pretty similar to the World Cup numbers, although, you know, some of those countries, like the Dutch, have never won a World Cup. And the Czechoslovakia winning one, that was the famous final against West Germany. That was the game where the Panenka was involved, was named, because Antonin Panenka took the final penalty of the shootout and he dinked it over the keeper when the keeper dived. That was the first Panenka. Now, keep in mind, Czechoslovakia, this is 1976. Czechoslovakia, behind the Iron Curtain, heavily repressed, all that kind of stuff. This guy had the fucking cojones to do this, knowing that if he fucked it up, he'd be working in a machine plant for the rest of his fucking life. Legend. Fucking legend, Antonin Panenka.
So there's a fair few countries that are pretty good in this tournament that could win for the first time.
Yeah, but it's going to be Germany or Spain because... Well, this is the thing. I mean, Germany are playing much better than they have for a very long time. It's easy to say, oh, you know, Germany always win this. No, Germany have been shit for multiple. I mean, they were average at Euro 2016, terrible at World Cup 2018.
Yeah, 96 was their last Euro win,
yeah,
too.
But their last title was the World Cup of 2014, which was the tournament in which they beat Brazil 7-1 in Brazil. That was a huge high point. And then shat the bed for... You know, they've been bad. They were bad in 2020. They were bad in the last World Cup. And this is the beginning of a cycle. So they shouldn't be ready for this yet. This is a little bit like OKC making the conference finals. It feels like a tournament cycle too early for this team, but they're going to have a crack and see how far they get. And the nation getting in behind them is actually good. It's a bit weird seeing a positive German team that everyone wants to support, but that's kind of what we got here. And Spain are a little bit like that too. I mean, they've had massive upheaval in the coaching stocks. You know, they had all the shit with the head of the federation getting run out of there for, you know, forcibly snogging the women's team when they won the World Cup in Australia and all that kind of shit. And, you know, there's corruption and all kinds of shit going on. But they're playing good football because they have good footballers and they have a decent coach who knows how to get out of the fucking way. Which is probably something that Gareth Southgate could take some advice from.
All right, Doc. Shall we come back and talk some music?
Let's do that. This was Balls Podcast. I was Doc. He's Bezo. We will talk to you again sometime between the end of the first round and the start of the round of 16.
Sounds good. All right. Catch you later.
And then...